Get a concise daily market update from Charles Schwab, including the latest on U.S. and global economic news, stock updates, monetary policy decisions, and key results and statistics that may impact your trading. Schwab Market Update, an original podcast from Charles Schwab, provides an information-packed daily market recap in 10 minutes or less. Listen today at schwab.com/marketupdatepodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated. Welcome to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. I'm Tom Keene with David Gura. Daily, we bring you insight from the best of economics, finance, investment, and international relations. Find Bloomberg Surveillance on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Bloomberg.com, and of course, on the Bloomberg.
Joining us now is James Sweeney, Chief Economist at Credit Suisse, Head of Global Fixed Income there as well. Great to see you here in our Bloomberg 1130 studios. And James, let me just start by asking you a bit about the Fed meeting yesterday, the degree to which your expectations were met. Let's talk about the balance sheet in a few moments. But first, when it came to the outlook and what they had to say, how did it jive with what you were expecting?
Yeah, well, I think the Fed was stoical in the sense that they were not moved by the recent weakness in inflation and the decline in some of the inflation expectation indicators. They did acknowledge it, but they went ahead and pulled the trigger on their hike, of course, and laid out that balance sheet policy. They still expect inflation to drift up towards their targets over the medium term, but they did reduce the path of that increase somewhat. So it looked safe and reasonable, but you know, I wrote a couple of weeks before the meeting that the Fed was ignoring the recent weakness in inflation, and I think the market is really ignoring the recent decrease in inflation. I hope I said decrease, and the market seems to be ignoring any possibility of an increase in inflation, a meaningful increase above that recent average. Over the next couple of years, it seems like the market and the Fed are jointly agreeing that inflation is a horizontal line right now, and as a result, the kind of expectations that exist for where short term rates will be a couple of years out are very low rates, very narrow path. I mean, everyone sort of agreed that 2-3 years from now we're going to have short term rates in the mid twos. And not much risk of being a lot higher or a lot lower. The options market actually confirms that narrow path, which is expected, and I think that's a little risky.
How do we get to this point where, as you point out, I think in a recent note, progress toward full employment trumps inflation and global industrial production growth, that the Fed is regarding that side of its mandate more than the other?
Yeah, well, as I said, I think the inflation news is being interpreted as a wobble against a kind of more or less horizontal trend. And what's happening in the labor market is labor income has slowed a little bit recently, but it continues to grow. And the unemployment rate is not falling at 85 basis points a year anymore, as it did from 2009 to 2015. But it does appear to still be falling. So, you know, we could have a three handle on the unemployment rate within a year, and in those conditions, it's appropriate to get short rates up to positive in real terms before long. The fact that risky asset prices across a broad spectrum of them are looking somewhat expensive from a historical perspective is another reason that that policy should be tightening, and so now the question really becomes the mode of that tightening. the sequencing of balance sheet versus rate, et cetera. But you know, they've now pulled the trigger and they've gotten all the way up from 0 to 25 to 1 to 1.25. That's a pretty big move, especially given the other developed central banks are really not moving rates at all.
James Sweeney with us from Credit Suisse. Let me ask you about the balance sheet and the detail that we got yesterday, the way in which they intend to do this compositionally and in terms of process itself. Was that in line with your expectations as well? And what does that tell you? What should that tell investors about the path forward here?
Some of the numbers they gave were a little more aggressive than we thought, and I think the amount of detail was sooner than we thought. And actually, we did slightly tweak our view in response to the news, where we now expect the balance sheet normalization to commence in September and the next rate hike not to happen until December. In 2018, we expect two more hikes. So we're only expecting three hikes over the next 18 months. But the balance sheet normalization to occur at the same time. So specifically, you know, they said that they would start out, I think it was $6 billion and $4 billion on Treasury and mortgages, where they would have a cap on how much runoff they're going to allow. You know, mm-hmm. runoff meaning they're not reinvesting coupons and principal for maturing securities. And as a result, their balance sheet is going to start shrinking, and then they're going to up it. Basically doubling those numbers after 3 months, and then they're going to do it again 3 months after that. And so if you go a year out, and if they do manage to kind of be on a glide path of balance sheet change, you know, within kind of a year, year and a half, they're going to be at QE2 levels of reverse QE, and the market will have to cope with that.
James Sweeney with us with Credit Suisse. Good morning, everyone. Bloomberg Surveillance. David Gurr and I. David, we got to thank all of our team yesterday. Yeah. For a marathon day, to say the least. And good to have you here, James, this morning on too many themes. One of the themes that we have is what the financial markets and the bond market is telling James Sweeney. I believe I'm seeing a flattening yield curve. Do you link that to slower GDP, or is it just a separate thing you're not worried about?
Well, you know, I think yields are pretty sensitive to what's happening in global growth, the news flow, the surprises, the PMIs, all that. We had an unusual period last year where global growth was very weak at the beginning of the year. It recovered throughout the year. Yeah. Yields didn't go up until the election. It was as if, you know, 7 months of move was concentrated into 3 or 4 weeks after the election. And we actually think global growth hit a local peak early this year, January, February, and has been coming off. So, you know, given some downside surprises in U.S. inflation and falling global growth, it's not so surprising that yields came back down again. But I think actually, you know, we've got a 280 target on the 10-year at the end of the year. My colleague Praveen Koraparty, our rate strategist. Mm-hmm. So I think global growth is going to pick up. I think the Fed is going to continue to implement its tightening. And I think we may be around a temporary low in the 10-year.
Right. Was it an ultra-accommodative press conference yesterday? Are we beyond ultra-accommodative? As you mentioned, they've done a set of rate increases in the world. I believe the world has not come to an end.
The stance of policy is accommodative. The incremental news from yesterday was somewhat more hawkish than the market expected, but not sufficiently hawkish to necessarily interrupt the party. I mean, I see the futures are down a little bit this morning on stocks. The market will take a little while to digest, but basically stocks and bonds across the board have been seeing price gains together for months and months as this low this easy monetary policy and low real rates have met with a growing U.S. economy and a wobbly but fine global economy. The question now is, could tighter monetary policy, you know, could that trigger higher yields? Mm-hmm. And could it even trigger some weakness in equity markets and risky assets? This has been a very technical market. There's a lot of frustrated traders out there, equity traders in particular. It's been a tough market to trade with really these tech stocks leading aggressively and the rest of the equity market behaving in some odd ways.
James, we've got about 30 seconds here. We'll come back with you. But let me ask you how indelible this plan for the balance sheet is. In other words, so with the potential for so much changeover at the Fed, how much credence do you give what we heard yesterday?
Yeah, I think there's a good chance that if we get a candidate, you know, outside of Gary Cohn, outside of Janet Yellen, that, you know, I would expect a Fed chair to obviously influence the implementation of the policy. There's nothing to say that this path can't be paused, can't be stopped. You know, I think there are other candidates from Yellen and Cohn. I think Kevin Warsh, for example, is leading candidate. And we will see. We will see. It should be interesting. I think the market is going to end up being very focused on this search for new leadership. And if it's Yellen, then we expect this path to continue. Of course.
Let's come back with James Sweeney of Credit Suisse. James, I got about 8 ways to go here, and I think I'm going to go Y equals C plus I plus G plus NX. And something I didn't talk about enough yesterday, which is investment. And the dearth of investment here, there, and everywhere. Do you care that commercial and industrial loans have rolled over, or any other investment parameter that shows a tepidness or weakness?
We care. In fact, we did a thorough piece on that recently. And
so how do you know I knew to ask that question?
Thank you, Tom. But what we found is that C&I loans really do very consistently lag what happened to investment last year. And so they're really not telling us about anything new. Last year, we had a couple things going on. We had a mining and energy investment slump, which was global. That was definitely weighing. In the U.S., we also had dollar strength weighing on manufacturing investment. So I'm not so worried about C&I loans. But I think on the investment side, there was a brief overshoot in expectations about what CapEx was going to do after the election and when the PMI spiked. Now that the PMIs have come off, I think people are calming down. So we have kind of mid-single-digit expectations for business investment in the U.S. going forward, which is okay. It's not great. It's not a boom. If you get an infrastructure stimulus, if you get tax reform, you know, maybe those numbers go higher. But I think the reality of this whole recovery, which is the absence of an investment boom despite very low interest rates, I think that's likely to persist for a while until we find some kind of trigger. I think it's possible, but we haven't had it yet. So investment's okay. It's not a disaster. And the specific shocks from the dollar and from energy are really falling out of the data now.
I'm watching the reaction here to the BOE rate decision on Top Live, on the Bloomberg, this live blog of what's happening. And so they're keeping the interest rate at 0.25%. Vote was 5-3. How big a deal is that divide among policymakers at the BOE? And what does it tell you about the Bank of England's engagement with the UK economy, with economic policy, and with this still ongoing Brexit process in the UK?
Well, you're always going to have some central bankers who are outside the consensus view. So, I recently read Sebastian Mallaby's new book on Alan Greenspan, and it was very interesting on the committee dynamics. I think during the Greenspan era, it became thought pretty widely that the leaders of central banks just make the decisions and the committees go along. And what Mallaby detailed was how much effort Greenspan used to put into bringing his whole committee along. It takes a lot of work to herd these cats. And maybe Carney has some work to do if he's got three dissenters at the moment. But most of the time, the governors, the chairs get their way. So, definitely in the UK, the outlook is a little confusing right now. High inflation, growth rolling over, but unemployment actually pretty low. And a lot of currency moves. So, you would forgive a group of central bankers or economists for having different views on where monetary policy ought to be.
Well, let's come full circle then. We were talking about Kevin Warsh and Gary Cohn and who might be leading this Fed going forward. Given what you were just saying, given what we've read in Sebastian Mallaby's book, how much determinism does the new Fed chair have? In other words, we're talking about the potential for a personnel turnover and all that might bring. Are we overplaying that, given what the committee is able to do?
No, I don't think so. I think I think it's very important who gets the leadership job. And I think whoever accepts the leadership job has to recognize that the president is going to be filling the seats around them. So some people are surprised that Janet Yellen is emerging as a pretty strong candidate. But even if it's Yellen, it's going to be Yellen with a very different group of governors around her. Some people would say that why would Yellen take such a job? Mm. But people close to Yellen say that, well, because she's very civic minded. And if she thinks that she's the best person for the job and it's good for the country, she may go ahead and do it. But I think we should definitely respect a wider range of possible outcomes, mm-hmm. given not just the potential change in the chair, but the potential change in those around it. Fed governors have been outvoted before. That mm-hmm. did happen to Volcker. It can happen. And in the Trump era, it's definitely something that should be on the list of possibilities.
Interesting. That's worth having you back on alone. James Sweeney, thank you so much. He is with Credit Suisse.
Story on the Bloomberg right now that Bob Mueller is examining whether President Trump sought to slow the probe into former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Good to talk about this here with one Richard Painter, former associate counsel to the president, chief ethics lawyer to George W. Bush, who joins us now, the Ritchie Professor of Corporate Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. Mr. Painter, great to have you with us here. Help me understand what's changed as a result of this turn, this next chapter in this investigation. It appears the investigation widens. What's changed?
Well, I think it was inevitable that the special counsel would investigate obstruction of justice by the president. The president, in his statements to the Russian ambassador, the news media, adding it all up, it's very clear that he certainly was very, very concerned about the Russian investigation when he fired James Comey. And it appears to me that he did fire James Comey because of the Russia investigation, not because of the pretense set forth in the Department of Justice memorandum. And, if so, that is a strong case for obstruction of justice. Whether it's a case that the special counsel would want to prosecute or not remains to be seen. But I think it was inevitable that there certainly would be an investigation of whether or not the president committed obstruction of justice of the sort that could be prosecuted.
How important do you think it's going to be, the interview that you mentioned, the interview during which President Trump sat down with Lester Holt of NBC News, the tweets that he's made about the circumstances surrounding this investigation? What role is all of that going to play here going forward?
Well, that's the information that we know of. That's what's public.
Yeah.
And I think that what is public, what constitutes a quite strong case of obstruction of justice. But what the special prosecutor will do is talk to others in the administration and find out what the president said privately. Did he talk to other people other than James Comey about trying to stop the Russia investigation? Did he talk to other people about what he said to James Comey? Those are the questions that are going to need to be answered. I think if people start to claim executive privilege with respect to that, the special prosecutor is going to have to go to court. And I think it's quite clear under the United States versus Nixon case that when it involves a criminal investigation, the claim of executive privilege is really quite weak.
Professor, let me ask a dumb question. Is there a chief White House ethics lawyer in the White House right now?
I believe so, they seem to have a very different approach to the ethics issues than we did in the Bush administration.
Is this lawyer
the Obama administration?
Is Mr. Kasowitz, just because of time, Professor, is Mr. Kasowitz competent to advise the president in Washington?
Well, first of all, Mr. Kasowitz is not the chief White House ethics lawyer. He is not a government employee. He's not on the White House counsel staff. So his job is only to advise the president in his personal capacity with respect to this investigation and defending himself against potential criminal charges. The other White House people are hiring their own criminal defense attorneys. And, there's a very, very important role for criminal defense lawyers in this situation. But it certainly isn't to try to advise people going forward as to what to do in their official capacity.
This was too short. Richard Painter, thank you so much with Minnesota and the University of Minnesota Law. We'll hope to get him back on soon. That was great. Mm-hmm. David, that was really quite good. Brought to you by Bank of America, Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith. Incorporated. This is going to be fun. And I don't mean working with David Gura. It's always fun.
Thank
which
you.
Is, yeah. It's always fun.
goes without
the mention. Journal of Economic Literature. I was reading it last night, David, because the Yankees were on late. Volume XXXVII, December 1999.
Oh, I remember it well.
The Science of Monetary Policy, a New Keynesian Perspective. Clarida Gertler. If you read it, you got to read this paper, folks. In fact, you'll probably reread it.
Can I borrow your microfiche machine to do that?
They lead with a quote from Alan Blinder. Having looked at monetary policy from both sides now, quoting Joni Mitchell, I can testify that central banking in practice is as much an art as science. I would suggest, Richard Clarida, that art was on display yesterday. It is amazing how complex the rationalization has gotten.
Yeah, well, I think what you're referring to is the fact that we got a rate hike from the Fed, even though the data has been soft. There's a Fed that says that they're data dependent. And I've said on this show before, data dependence itself is not a monetary policy. So we saw that on full display. So the data would have suggested pausing, but they hiked. Why did they hike? I think two big reasons. The first is they clearly want to get the balance sheet reduction underway, and they set a standard for themselves, which is we can't really think about the balance sheet normalization until hikes are well underway. So yesterday was the fourth. So I think that was definitely a factor. I think the other factor as well is the factor of the matter is that their models are telling them policy's still accommodative. They're raising rates, but they don't think they're tightening policy. Financial conditions are very easy, so they saw an open door. They took advantage of it. But I must admit, it created sort of an interesting press conference.
Well, I'll say the least. On page 4 or 5 of Clarida Gellie-Gertler, 1999, you walked through the mathematics of the economy, the IS curve, knocked up against what Chair Yellen talked about yesterday, this strange thing called the Phillips curve. Does the math in that paper in 1999 still work?
Well, the Phillips curve obviously is a very important part of that analysis, and Chair Yellen herself is an expert on it and made mention of it several times. So far, we're not seeing the traditional Phillips relationship unemployment and inflation. Interestingly enough, we are seeing some evidence of the Phillips curve effect in wages, once you adjust for the fact that productivity is low. But I think the big thing that the Fed's probably noticing, although they didn't dwell on it yesterday, is in January, year-over-year core inflation was at 1.8, very close to 2%, and now it's about 1.5. So it's going in the wrong direction. I think that's probably more of a concern. It's moving in the wrong direction. They hope it's temporary, but so far can't tell.
Yeah. David, if the kids can't sleep tonight, you can just read in the footnotes from Clarida Gellie and Gertler. Footnote 24, that's my favorite right there, footnote 24.
Let's borrow your much-loved copy of that. Rich Clarida, let me ask you about what we learned about the balance sheet yesterday and how that changes your perspective on what things are going to be like going forward here. We got some numbers, have a better sense perhaps of the timetable for it. From an investor's perspective, what does that mean?
You know, I think David, it's a good question because I think an underreported fact of the Fed's plan is with these caps they announced, the Fed is still going to be buying treasuries and mortgage-backed securities. So you tell your listeners they want to shrink the balance sheet. Oh, and by the way, every month they're still buying. You think, well, what, you know, that's sort of like I'm going on a diet, but I'm gonna have a two desserts. And interestingly enough, one reason why the bond markets, I think, David, have taken this so well is that essentially as a treasury matures, they're going to replace it with a 5 or a 10-year treasury. If you adjust their portfolio for the duration, that is the maturity, it may not be shrinking at all. So one reason the bond market has been pretty relaxed is, you know, this is not a very austere or dramatic reduction in the balance sheet once you adjust for they're going to continue to buy.
What was Chair Yellen's message to those who are skeptical about where inflation is right now vis-a-vis the Fed's willingness or eagerness to keep hiking? The word transitory came up, I know, but how forcefully is she defending that position?
Well, basically yesterday, David, I'd summarize the one-hour press conference in two words. She was saying, trust me.
Uh-huh.
You know, it's a complicated world.
That is in Clarida Gellie-Gertler.
She said, trust me. You know, implicitly, I'm an expert. I've been doing this for 30 years. You know, inflation goes up, it goes down. Trust me, she gave the little analogy about, you know, the arithmetic of the CPI with cell phone prices. I don't think that third rate hike that the blue dots indicated yesterday is a slam dunk. I think they will commence the balance sheet process in the fall. But if the fall is underwhelming as so far the first half of the year has been, they may not get that third rate hike in.
Do we get any better sense of what full employment is to policymakers on the Fed?
Well, you know, they keep revising down the unemployment rate, which is consistent with full employment. So 3 years ago, it was 5.3. Now it's at 4.6, I think. The actual unemployment rate is lower. And I think, David, the pattern has been as unemployment continues to fall and inflation doesn't pick up, they keep revising down. I'm not critical for that. Yeah. You know, as the data evolves, they do need to factor that in.
Within, trust me. And within the wonderful work that you are acclaimed for, I did a word search. Joe Stiglitz's name is not in there. He is acclaimed with Sandy Grossman about what's the information we have in the market. What's the information Chair Yellen or Vice Chairman Fisher or Lyle Brainard, what's the information, the signals that they're getting right now? Are a la Grossman and Stiglitz, are they flying blind?
Well, that is a classic paper. It's called The Impossibility of Informationally Efficient Markets. You know, you can tell I've read it. But I think there is an I think there is an analogy, Tom, and it's the following.
Are you liking this girl?
The Fed is trying to actually navigate and work through a pretty complicated signal extraction problem. And in particular, there's mixed messages. So, for example, bond yields have fallen. Mm-hmm. Now, bond yields can fall for a couple of reasons, and they're trying to distinguish whether or not that's a signal the economy's weakening or if it's just telling you something that there are negative rates in the rest of the world. The other signal extraction problem that they have, of course, is this inflation problem. Is it transitory or permanent? And then financial conditions. Financial conditions are easier. Stocks are higher. Credit spreads are lower. Does that tell them they should hike more aggressively, or does that tell them basically just to take it easy? So it is a pretty complicated problem right now.
We've gone graduate school, PhD on everybody out there, and this is really special with Richard Claret of Columbia University and, of course, with PIMCO. So with what you just said, I'm going to go to the Greek letter theta, which is belief in the time function. Trust me, on the time function, do you have a belief in transitory out to a permanent effect on, in this case, inflation? I mean, do you have a knowledge of how to parse between transitory or permanent? Well, or are we just flying blind again?
Well, the reality, and I've actually done empirical work in this and I know the literature, the reality is that the econometrics of signal extraction in the real world are actually quite complicated.
Thank
so
you.
Even though the Fed has 250 PhD economists and does brilliant econometric work, there's a pretty big element of judgment involved as well. And so it's a combination of statistical models and sort of gut feeling.
In the time that we've got left then, should we go to a more rules-based Fed away from that gut feel that you just spoke? If we get Marvin Goodfriend as chairman because Claret is too much discretion-based, do we need a more rules-based Fed?
Well, of course, that
paper. I'm busting his chops
That paper, Claret and Galli-Gerler, actually proposed what we called a forward-looking Taylor rule. So I'm very much in the camp that a rules-based approach makes sense. I wouldn't be handcuffed to it, but it's an essential input to doing sound policy.
Can I, David, I got to say this, folks. When we invented Bloomberg on the Economy and Bloomberg Surveillance, Al Mayer said to me, you can't do that every show.
But every once in a while,
John Tucker, we go off the rails and we just
into
did
the
that
surveillance library.
Professor Claret, this will be out for your re-listening pleasure, John. This will be out on iTunes.
Double check those Roman numerals that you wrote down.
This will be on iTunes podcast into Global Wall Street, what you just heard there from Richard Claret. It was just special. I can't say
Theta Thursday.
About Theta Thursday. Yeah. I like that. Very good. We'll go with it.
Richard Claret, appreciate you being here. Richard Claret in our Bloomberg 1130 studios, of course, of PIMCO and Columbia University as well. We'll be talking more about the Fed coming up here with Craig Bishop of RBC as well.
I promise I will tweet out some of what Professor Claret and I were talking about because it is really important work and the foundations for what is being debated as in the press conference yesterday. That was special, Richard Claret at PIMCO. is a really interesting, what I'm going to call, political scientist and economist. Diana Furchtgott-Roth joins us now with the Manhattan Institute. For years, in support of a certain kind of political science, and that's something that many Republicans are very comfortable with, and maybe the president as a Republican is comfortable with, and she will join us now. How's the president doing, Diana? Just to begin with the idea of Trump fiscal economics. Is it cogent?
The president wants to lower spending and reduce taxes, which is a very cogent policy. Absolutely. And it's worked in other countries. It's worked in the United States. And almost everybody agrees that our deficit is too large, our debt is too large. We're passing this on to our grandchildren who have no...
I agree. Yes. I agree. Everyone agrees with this. But the,
exactly.
Did he, and I mean this with great respect for the debate, folks, and we get tons of mail when Dr. Furchtgott-Roth is on with us. When he effected his first budget proposal, was that a political document or was that a Diana Furchtgott-Roth document with some real meat to it?
This was President Trump's view of what the budget should look like, of what the federal government budget should look like. And it had cuts in many places, and it had increases in national defense. And that goes along with what President Trump proposed during his campaign. So it was a document aligned with his policy promises during the campaign. And I should just say, I am not doctor. I'm just Diana Furchtgott-Roth. I have an MPhil in economics from Oxford.
Very good.
Excuse me. See, that's what you get from someone like Oxford. Everybody else is walking around all day. I'm a doctor. I'm a doctor. Excuse
me.
We try to make note of that. I do agree with Diana that should
be. Well, it's just I don't want to be on your show under false pretense.
Very good. Very good.
Diana, excuse me. I'm on this show under false pretenses. David, save me.
Let me ask you just about the degree. There are those who complain that the president drafted this document in a vacuum. He wasn't thinking about what Congress would think of it, what Republicans in Congress in particular would think about it. I look at the reception that it got on Capitol Hill, and there were a good quantity of Republicans, fellow Republicans, who weren't happy with it. How problematic is that? In other words, he's laying out the strictures for what he wants. Should he have had more political awareness about what was more possible?
All presidents lay out their wish list for a budget, and then it's up to Congress and the president to negotiate over what finally comes out. I don't think you could think of any congressional budget over the past half century that's come out exactly the way the president asked for. So President Trump's budget is not at all unusual. It's his wish list. It's his vision as to where the economy should go and where the budget should go.
Does he have enough awareness of the funding deadline that's coming up? We haven't heard a lot of clarity from this White House about the debt ceiling, say, its approach to the debt ceiling, or indeed its approach to this September 30th deadline. Do his colleagues need to come out more forcefully here to say what the White House's position on all of that is?
President Trump has an excellent set of economic advisors. Gary Cohn, head of the National Economic Council. My friend Kevin Hassett will be starting off as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors. I'm sure they have fully made him aware of all the deadlines.
Diana, does he need to be more incremental? I mean, so much of the liberal critique of the Trump budgets and discussion so far, is it just too much, too hard, too soon, too abrupt? Is there something to be said for gradation?
I think that this proposed budget has been maligned. First of all, people say it cuts spending. It doesn't. It raises federal spending by about $1.7 trillion over the next 10 years. It says it cuts Medicaid, and no, it raises the amount of money spent on Medicaid over the next 10 years. Some functions of government that were perfectly reasonable 30 or 40 or 50 years ago, such as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, are no longer reasonable in light of all the multitude of radio and TV stations that we have right now. Why should it be the government's role to fund television and radio when there are shows like yours that do fine without government money? So I think that a budget should always be a time of looking over what the government role should be in light of changes in the economy. and yeah. have people jump up and down and say, we need a government radio and TV station. Yes, well, we might have needed one 50 years ago. We certainly do not need one now. That's not something that taxpayers should have to fund.
Diana, I'm going to ruin your morning and come back and talk about health care. Diana Firthgott-Rotz is with us with the Manhattan Institute. Diana, let me give you an open question to get the conversation going. David Gura is poised to pounce. How close are we to socialized medicine?
Oh, we're not close to socialized medicine, I would say. I would say that we can see that the Obamacare exchanges are crumbling. We have United Healthcare pulling out, Aetna, Anthem pulling out. But I don't think that single payer is going to be replacing the Obamacare exchanges. We're probably going to have more competition, more choice for consumers. That's what people want. That's what the Senate is working on right now. That was in the House bill.
Where is your optimism for that happening? We look at the congressional calendar, how compressed it is, how full it is, and we see the Senate's unwillingness to take up the House bill as the starting point for what it's going to ultimately draft. Where does your optimism when it comes to health care come from?
Well, Senator Mitch McConnell is crafting his own bill, which is going to be ready around July the 4th, he says, or perhaps later. Senator McConnell is an extraordinarily smart man who knows parliamentary procedure, and I'm sure that between House Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell, they can get it done because this is what voters elected them to do. They were elected on a platform of repealing Obamacare. Premiums are rising 25% to 50% every year. It's unsustainable. Insurance companies are dropping out. United Healthcare, Anthem, Aetna.
Okay, so give me the. I'm really fascinated by this, folks. If it's 16% or 17% of GDP, and every single guest from Uwe Reinhardt to Diana Firthgott-Rotz says we got to fix it, what's your prescription, given the realities of 2018 society?
Well, the prescription is that insurance companies should be allowed to offer the plans that people want to buy, which is not the case right now. Right now, each insurance company has to offer the same plan with the same offerings, so there isn't any competition between them. If I want to buy a plan that just covers major expenses, such as falling off my bike in traffic when I bike to work, or getting cancer or a heart attack, I'm not allowed to do that. I have to buy a plan with maternity care, mental health coverage, drug abuse coverage, all these bells and whistles that I don't necessarily want. Well, of course, this is raising the price of health insurance, and we need a different system. Just like with auto insurance, we can do auto insurance because people think about auto insurance. No one ever says, I'm losing my job, I'm going to lose my auto insurance. No, because you buy it outside the system. You have a choice of plans. You have a choice of deductibles. You can have collision. And we can do the same kinds of things.
To be fair, though, I have to buy it. In order to get a license, I have to prove that I have auto insurance.
Yes, but you don't have to buy a very expensive plan that changes your oil, that pays for changing your oil, pays for routine maintenance. That's what you have to buy for health care. And I do agree that in the new health care bills, there should be a penalty for not having coverage. Otherwise, you're going to have people game the system and just pick up the insurance when they have a problem. And there are protections against that in other markets. Like, you can't just buy home insurance when your house is on fire. You can't just buy car insurance when you're engaged, when you have a major crash. It should be the same with health insurance.
We have been talking about monetary policy all morning in light of the Fed meeting yesterday. Let me ask you about fiscal policy last week. The White House christened last week as infrastructure a week. How optimistic are you that we're going to see some sort of fiscal package here within the year? Do you think that the White House is prioritizing that enough?
You mean an infrastructure package?
Indeed. The trillion-dollar plan that the president discussed in that speech before a joint session of Congress.
Well, the trillion-dollar plan also means reducing barriers to private sector companies building infrastructure. That's a large part of the plan. The president is very serious about reducing all the duplication that there is in the permitting. He came out with a huge pile of environmental impact statements that were used for a connector road between I-95 and 270 and said it was too big. He's absolutely right. That raised the price of doing that road, of building that road. So now the tolls on that road have to be higher than they would be otherwise, reducing the ridership. These regulations are really getting in the way of private companies building infrastructure. And a large part of the president's plan, as he said, is going to be encouraging public-private partnerships, reducing regulations, encouraging the private sector to build its own infrastructure, getting out of the way.
When you look at public-private partnerships, what's the role of them in improving or building on our infrastructure here in the U.S.? Is that the end goal to move to that realm entirely? What role should public-private partnerships play when it comes to infrastructure?
Well, the end goal should be moving towards a situation where they are much more private and much less public, but in situations where the federal government actually owns the assets, such as the bridge or the highway or the airport, then the federal government has to do some kind of permission, some kind of agreement to allow the private sector to invest. But there should be the maximum private sector investment possible.
I look at what is going on here now in the cacophony in the White House. Have you spoken to the president recently, Diana?
I have never spoken to the president. I was part of his team, but not everyone on his team spoke to the president.
Okay, well, that's fair as well. What would be your prescription for the White House to get a more cogent budget plan, fiscal plan, linked with all the other distractions out there?
I think that the White House is producing these budget plans, and I would suggest that the next step is for Congress to actually take them up and implement them. It's Congress that's the bottleneck. It's people who are saying Congress, and you said it earlier in the program. Mm. How is Congress going to pass tax reform? How's it going to pass health care reform with the few legislative days left? Well, I suggest that Congress take part of the August recess and stay in Washington to work on these items and also move the process through faster. Yesterday, due to the extremely tragic shooting of Steve Scalise, there was very little done, which is understandable. But Congress needs to make up that time and move these bills through. There's also debt ceiling problems, budget. There's many things to do, infrastructure.
Well, let's leave it there. Diana, thank you so much. Diana Fritschko-Throth is with the Manhattan Institute. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Surveillance Podcast. Subscribe and listen to interviews on Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, or whichever podcast platform you prefer. I'm on Twitter at Tom Keen. David Gura is at David Gura. Before the podcast, you can always catch us worldwide on Bloomberg Radio. Brought to you by Bank of America Merrill Lynch. With virtual reality, virtually everything will change. Discover opportunities in a transforming world. BofAML.com/VR. Merrill Lynch, Pierce, Fenner & Smith, Incorporated.
Osage County, Oklahoma is getting a lot of attention right now. It's the setting of Martin Scorsese's latest film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The movie is based on a book about the 1920s Osage murders, when white men poured into Osage County and killed Osage people for their oil wealth. I'm Rachel Adams Heard, the host of In Trust, a podcast from Bloomberg and iHeartMedia. For over a year, I was reporting a different story about other ways white people got Osage land and wealth, and how a prominent ranching family in Osage County became one of the biggest landowners here. Their ranching empire was built on land that at the turn of the century was all owned by the Osage Nation. So how'd they get it? Listen to the award-winning podcast, In Trust, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.